The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I just wanted to say out loud, in case it doesn't go without saying, that we know this topic can be really difficult to think and talk about and absorb, and so please feel free to do whatever you need to do to be comfortable. If you need to take a break, step outside, absolutely fine. Nobody will look at you funny for being human, having emotions throughout this this talk. So just wanted to say that before we begin. And I also wanted to start by acknowledging some pretty painful realities that 1 in 2 transgender people in the United States is estimated to experience sexual violence in this country. U.S. capitalism relies on a really rigid gender binary that makes trans people disposable and makes trans identity threatening. And so in addition to sexual violence that can take place at school, at work, trans people are also often assaulted in other conditions, like in homeless shelters, in prisons, by police who criminalize their means of survival. The murder of dozens of trans women of color each year is made invisible in this country, not only by misgendering victims, but also by simply labeling them as sex workers, whether they actually were or not. So to understand how we've gotten to this intensely violent society, I think I wanted to start by discussing some of the kind of foundational chapters of U.S. history and the development of U.S. capitalism that shape how and why sexual violence takes place today. Native women are also estimated to have some of the highest rates of sexual violence per capita in the United States. Native lawyer and survivors advocate and MacArthur genius, Sarah Deer, writes in a book called The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America, that 1 in 3 Native women endures rape in her lifetime. And she also argues that that really can't be understood outside of the context of colonialism. She explains that in many pre-colonial indigenous communities, interpersonal violence of any kind was uncommon, with incidents of rape being rare within within tribes. So the story of how a crisis of sexual violence has been imposed on Native communities is both critical to understand in its own right as we live and struggle on stolen land, but it's also very instructive of what kind of material conditions give rise to sexual violence and the kind of ideological trappings that try to normalize it. So Deer draws on her own Muscogee tribe's traditions as an example of the relative equality that people of several genders enjoyed before European settlers arrive. She writes that in 1825, members of the tribe were kind of compelled to write down some of their oral traditions, which translated that in response to rape, quote, "It shall be left to woman what punishment she should be satisfied with, what she say it be law." Which is pretty incredible, I think, as a tradition. Meanwhile, she says, for most of American legal history, rape was framed as a property crime committed against men. In 1825, state laws often required 2 eyewitnesses to convict a man for rape. A woman's word alone was never sufficient. And the lack of rape committed by Indian men was a source of frustration for colonial authorities. Writers of so-called captivity narratives, who sought stories of the supposed brutality of Indians, sometimes documented their disbelief that Indian men did not frequently rape European prisoners of war. Of course, there's nothing that's built into human nature that compels sexual violence. What actually demands explanation is how sexual violence can ever come to appear so normal. Colonization really stamped gendered inequality into the fabric of Native lives in a whole variety of ways, from uprooting economies that were based on a balanced division of labor to the forced removal of whole tribes, during which sexual violence often occurred on the course of forced marches. America's first enslaved people were indigenous people who were kidnapped and forced to work, among other things, sometimes as sexual slaves. Colonial settlers from Columbus's ships onward regularly used sexual violence as a tool to brutalize women and to degrade and terrorize whole communities. Deer points out that rape is a frequent tool of genocide because it can reduce reproduction, and that indeed there's documentation that sexual violence led Indian women to induce abortions or otherwise control their fertility. And U.S. policy and practice toward American Indians has continued to encourage and conceal sexual violence, whether in Indian boarding schools or through abuse that's carried out with impunity by federal employees. Deer writes about all of this. Throughout this long history of colonization, rape has been used to denigrate Native women in ways that first made it justifiable for non-Natives to commit sexual assault, and later, was sort of incorporated into Native communities as well. To draw this out, from the earliest days of colonization, French Jesuits recorded that they were baffled and sometimes horrified by the sexual and political autonomy Native women enjoyed. And U.S. politicians and courts have really held on to that kind of contempt for Native women as supposedly less moral than white women, including through explicit laws that impose lighter sentences for the rape of Native women. As late as 1968, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of that kind of a law that was still in practice in Arizona. So crucially, Deer writes, quote, "Tribal nations were not mere passive recipients of this violence. Many so-called Native rebellions, outbreaks, and uprisings have been linked to the rape of Native women, thus linking resistance to rape to the exercise of tribal sovereignty." Her examples cover a wide range of history, beginning with 18th century revolts against Spanish missions spurred by sexual violence. Later, Deer suggests that, among other causes, the refusal of U.S. authorities to do anything about settler rape set off the U.S.-Dakota War of 1862 in southern Minnesota. If people don't know much about the Sioux Uprising, it came after the forced removal of the tribe to a reservation, broken treaties, near starvation, when Dakota Chief Little Crow attempted to negotiate with U.S. officials. One of the lead traders, Andrew Jackson Merrick, famously told the Dakota could, quote, "eat grass or their own dung." In this context, sexual violence both reflected and reinforced the dehumanizing racism of Dakota resettlement. The U.S. response to the Sioux Uprising was brutal, culminating in the largest mass execution in U.S. history. 38 Dakota men were killed in one day. Another example of Native resistance that Deer points to is Sarah Winnemucca, who in 1883 became the first Native woman to publish a nonfiction book in the United States. Her book, Life Among the Paiute, included specific stories of sexual violence and described how the violence of colonialism imprinted itself into widespread sexual violence within her tribe. Deer points out that Winnemucca's work was especially groundbreaking in the Victorian era, in which even white women activists, did not discuss sexuality or sexual violence in public. More recently, women like Tilly Black Bear and Lenora Hooch have anchored networks that provide shelter and services to Native survivors who've been totally failed by federal authorities. Deer herself played an important role in the 2013 reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act in a way that partially addressed some huge loopholes in jurisdiction that have kept Native women from seeking justice when they're sexually attacked by non-Natives. More generally, she makes the case that we have to link the urgency of Native women fighting for an end to sexual violence and their own personal autonomy with the larger fight to restore self-determination for tribal communities as a whole. She offers what she calls an indigenous theory of rape, which transcends what have been described as a conservative conception of rape as a property crime against men, the liberal theory of rape as a physical crime just against our bodies, or even radical theories of rape conceived as a social and political violation of our public status. She explains that Native experience reveals how rape can be an attack on, quote, body, mind, and spirit, an attack on a survivor's wholeness and humanity. The fight to reclaim jurisdiction over sexual violence is therefore not just metaphorically significant of the broader fight for indigenous sovereignty in practical terms. It could afford Native survivors an alternative to U.S. courts that deny justice to survivors of all identities, and a chance to instead use our own their own direct experiences to put forward new conceptions of what sexual violence is and what the remedies could look like. Now, Native history challenges the superficially compelling assertion that sexual violence results from or is the basis of an ahistorical conflict between men and women. Rape is so prevalent in society nowadays that both the Boys Will Be Boys apologists and many of the most influential feminists tend to share the assumption that the urge towards sexual violence is just built into our biology. Instead, I think this history shows why we need to use a Marxist method to locate the roots of sexual violence and historic conditions that shape specific conflicts between between people of different genders and races and ethnicities. Now, Engels, Frederick Engels in Origins of the Family, Private Property, and the State provides a framework for understanding gendered inequality as part of the creation of unequal societies overall. For thousands of years, small groups of people had shared the equality of scarcity, reliance on one another in order to produce what they needed to survive. As humanity began to produce more than they needed for subsistence, gradually a minority started to be able to control that surplus. And the people with control over the wealth found that they needed to control women's production, reproduction in order to pass that ownership down. They also found that they needed to consolidate their control as a class over society as a whole through the structure of states. Engels described how the male-headed family replaced the matrilineal kin groups that had predominated before and called this the world historic defeat of the female sex. He noted that the term familia comes from ancient Rome, where it referred to all of the human property of a man's household, including wife, children, and slaves. And he condemned the rape of slave women by their owners that went hand in hand with the restriction on their wives' sexual lives. He argued that class societies in general both repress sexuality and autonomy of some women through institutions like marriage, and at the same time degrade and commodify women's bodies and lives in other ways. There's an Indian Marxist named Maya John who expands on Engels' work to look at how conceptions of rape have transformed as class societies have developed. She writes, quote, "It was originally defined as an abduction of a woman against the will of the man under whose authority she lived, and sexual intercourse was not a necessary element. Rape was initially identified as a crime against the concerned woman's community and family, not as an assault on a woman's body without her consent. Not surprisingly, then, women, too, came to be punished for indulging in sexual activity without the permission of their families and communities," end quote. Now, this conception of rape predates the recognition of individual subjects under criminal law. John draws on Engels' approach of viewing changes in production, reproduction, and law as interrelated to show that class societies, as class societies became increasingly stratified, women's productive work became less central to their roles in society. Their role in reproduction became more tightly constrained, and the need for individuals to choose and consent to sex gained legal recognition. However, in the context of enforced monogamy for women but not for men, Maya John writes, quote, "A woman's consent was accounted for and considered only after it was conditioned to mean a consent given to just certain men and not to others." I think we can build on that contradiction. Excuse me. And Engels' observations to look at how this shapes sexual violence under capitalism as a specific form of class society. Both women's idealized role as mothers and our objectified portrayal as objects of male pleasure negate our wholeness as human beings and our claim over our own bodies. Worldwide capitalism relies on the unpaid labor that working class families perform in order to keep ourselves equipped for work from one day to the next and to raise the next generations of workers. As Lisa Vogel argues in Marxism and the Oppression of Women, capitalism also relies on the political stability that privatized social reproduction affords by requiring working class people to rely on one another for both our comfort in life and to mete out some of the frustrations of our lives. I think understanding these material roots is really important in as much as it looks beyond the appearance of sexual violence as an innate conflict between genders or an unwinnable conflict with dominant culture. But it's also only a general framework, and sexual violence has been used as a tool of racism, of homophobia, of transphobia, and of imperial warfare overseas. So I want to go back to some of the specific conditions in U.S. history and look at the rise of racialized slavery around the end of the 17th century. Angela Davis writes in her really indispensable Women, Race, and Class how sexual violence served as ubiquitously as the lash under racialized slavery in the United States. She writes, quote, rape it was in fact an uncamouflaged expression of the slaveholder's economic mastery and the overseer's control over black women as workers. She cites numerous examples of enslaved women talking about the backbreaking pace of work and intensity of their work, which was equal to enslaved men's measure for measure. And I think it's also important to note that the U.S. courts at this time, refused to recognize any kind of right of enslaved women over their own bodies. There was the 1855 case of Missouri v. Celia, which is fairly well known. Celia had been 14 in 1850 when Robert Newsom purchased her and began a five-year onslaught of sexual violence against her. She bore two children in that time. In 1855, pregnant for a third time, Celia fought back in self-defense and killed Newsom. Ultimately, she confessed under serious intimidation, and she was sentenced by a jury of 12 white men to murder in the first degree and was given the death penalty. The Supreme Court denied her an appeal, and she was murdered before the year was over. Celia's rape and murder and the full weight of U.S. government saying that was perfectly fine and legal was one of the things that added heat to the conflict over slavery in the years before the Civil War. Numerous slave narratives talked about the widespread use of sexual violence, and that was incredibly important in terms of motivating an abolitionist movement, especially among some of the white women in the North who are an important part of abolitionist societies. Now, Davis emphasizes that individual lust or malice were not necessary components of rape under slavery. In the 19th century, Congress banned the import of any new slaves, and so that put a lot of emphasis on sexual violence in order to produce new wealth in the form of enslaved people. There's a number of different really incredible slave narratives that survive today that document that. I'm going to actually skip over some of the examples for the sake of time. But I just think given women's equally brutal treatment as workers under slavery and the fact that they endured this incredible amount of sexual violence, it's not at all surprising that they often played a really leading role in resistance efforts, everything from teaching themselves to read, which was illegal, and teaching others to read, to fleeing to and defending maroon communities, planning and urging revolts, and leading escapes. Enslaved women also resisted the removal of their children from them by any means that they could. Unfortunately, as Davis explains, sociologists and politicians have used the history of slavery to really demonize the black family, to paint it as the, collapsed under slavery and has just never been able to recover. And they use that lie in order to scapegoat black families for the conditions of poverty and racism that black people endure today. And so I think, it's clear that this isn't just a distant part of our embarrassing history. This is very much a part of the racist present that we live in this country, where black women are far more likely to have their children removed from them in instances of domestic violence, which is where much of today's sexual violence takes place. It's also the case that black women are unfortunately often assaulted by police. That's the second most common form of misconduct complaint against police today. And only one in 15 black survivors are estimated to report their rapes. So I think all of that goes to that history. Now, Davis also writes about an intensifying ideology of women's role as wives and mothers that accompanied the same era of industrialization in the United States. Women's work in their homes had been central to the survival of farming families, but industrialization meant that now there were products on offer that replaced some of that work, but that required waged work in order to buy them. And so there becomes this cult of true womanhood and of motherhood that didn't have so much to do with like a sudden importance of women's work in the home. It actually had to do with demeaning women's work in the home and separating it out from public life. That meant that white women in the abolitionist movement had to overcome a lot of hostility to their political activity, but it also meant that poor women were forced out of their homes and into the factories. I wanted to talk a little bit about what they experienced. I found a pamphlet written by a woman named Mary Bulzerich called Sexual Harassment in the Workplace, Historical Notes. Starts off talking about the Lowell girls of the 1830s who were very frequently, who went to work in the textile mills and, around Lowell. Who were frequently maligned as prostitutes, whether they were or not. Prominent citizens would write into their local newspapers complaining about you know, these women's loose morals and claiming to know of networks through which men could purchase their company. But while the sale of their labor power may have scandalized the upper classes, working women in fact endured widespread sexual harassment at work, including threats, coercion, assault, attempted rape, and rape. The era's cult of true womanhood held women morally responsible for any sexual contact, including that imposed on them. And mill workers really consciously promoted this idea of mill workers as morally weak. Bulzerich argues that this created a climate that really reduced the confidence of workers who are being made to work 14-hour days for very low wages, and also provided a free perk to mid-level male employees. And Lowell women actually engaged in some of the first strikes by women workers in 1834 and 1836. They demanded shorter hours and better wages. And while their strikes weren't successful, their courage spread to other workers in New England at the time. And they also caused a national uproar because they involved, quote, parading around, making speeches, passing resolutions, holding meetings, all behavior not deemed proper for women. By the late 19th century, a growing women's workforce included many immigrant and black workers who confronted sexual violence and harassment at a wide range of workplaces. Individually, many of these workers blamed themselves, you know, tried to leave jobs where there was a particularly bad boss and find a different job. But a lot of people also recognized that this was a shared problem and tried to figure out how to organize around it. There was a group of New York garment workers who formed the Young Ladies Educational Society, which unfortunately was organized on a very racist basis, but it attempted to formalize a network to resist harassment at work. There was also the Working Women's Society, which later became the Women's Trade Union League, which formed for the same purpose. They published a magazine called Life and Labor, in which they shared many stories. One of them really struck a chord with me, of a worker named Rosa, whose first sentence in English she learned from fellow workers, and it was, "Keep your hands off, please." Women also sought to join unions, and that could be a very difficult process. At the time, unions tended to be male-dominated, could be very intimidating, but they did sometimes succeed in actually challenging sexist bosses. And by the 20th century, they allowed women garment workers in particular to fight back in the tens of thousands over wages and working conditions. So this early U.S. history shows again and again how resistance to sexual violence can spur much larger struggles. I wanted to go to one last example really briefly from Danielle McGuire's book, At the Dark End of the Street, which goes through really incredible history of struggles black women led during Jim Crow in particular against some of the sexual violence was really central to the kind of racist terror that underpinned segregation. One of the examples she talks about is Rosa Parks, who was an anti-rape activist long before she defied Jim Crow in Montgomery. She formed a group called the Committee for Equal Justice to defend a woman named Recy Taylor, who was a young sharecropper and mother who was abducted and raped by a gang of white men in Alabama in 1944. That group built an international campaign in the midst of World War II that shamed the United States as a supposed defender of freedom for, you know, the nightmare of racism in the South. And while they unfortunately didn't win justice for E.C. Taylor at the time, that organization actually went on, many of the people in it went on to become the Montgomery Improvement Association, which organized and ran the Montgomery bus boycott in 1954. Even before that, Parks had worked really hard to defend the Scottsboro Boys, who were nine young black boys accused of raping two white women in 1931 and sentenced to death. There were mass marches and campaigns. I won't talk about that struggle because I think people can bring that in from the floor. A national struggle to save their lives. Now, just want to end on a couple of points about that, though. Angela Davis and others have linked the seemingly contradictory faces of sexual violence in the South, pointing out that both the stereotype of the black male rapist and the ability of white women or white men to rape black women with impunity depend on a dehumanization of black people in the South. She also argues that white women have suffered a ricochet of the violence endured by black women as white men transferred that violence of white supremacist terror into their own homes and communities. And so I wanted to close on the words of Anne Braden, who was a lifelong radical born and raised in Alabama, who drew really key insight from her involvement in the fight to save the life of Willie McGee, who was a black man sentenced to death in Mississippi in 1951. Through a legal lynching on false rape charges. She writes that she felt compelled to organize against a racist injustice being committed in defense of what was a totally suffocating version of white femininity that she also had to fight back against in her own life and her own career. After being arrested and telling off the cop, who she said went quickly from wanting to protect her to wanting to kill her, she says, quote, "I suddenly felt free, really free for the first time in my life. Free that day I spent in jail, the first time I'd been in jail. I think now that I knew instinctively, even then, that I had reached a turning point in my life, and in a sense, a point of no return. For in an exploitative society, there are always two sides, and at some point, one must choose."
All right, thanks so much, Rachel. That was great, as always. So for my section, I'm going to be emphasizing the history of anti-rape activism, mainly which took place during the women's liberation movement of the 60s and the 70s, sometimes referred to as the second wave. Then I'm going to wrap up by highlighting what I think are some of the most inspiring examples that hold a lot of lessons for us today, highlighting black women's activism that took place across multiple movements. I wanted to start off by just saying that I'm going to use some terminology in a very different way than it's popularly used today. Specifically, I'm going to talk about patriarchy theory, which refers to a very specific set of politics, not really the vague synonym for sexism, which is how it's kind of commonly used today. And also, when I refer to radical feminism, for most of my talk, that's also referring to a very specific set of politics, not just in general leftist or anti-capitalist or something like that. Resistance to sexual assault did not exclusively originate with the rise of feminism in the United States, but the women's liberation movement of the late 60s and 70s did produce for the first time a popular understanding of rape as a woman's issue. The activism and theory produced by this movement had a profound effect throughout US society, and its influence is still very much visible in today's struggles. In January 1971, 300 people gathered in a church in New York City to participate in a speak out on rape organized by the New York Radical Feminists. Inspired by the success of an earlier abortion speak out, this public event was an early attempt by ordinary women to bring their personal experiences of violence to light. 12 women organizers shared their stories, and 28 others chose to speak from the audience. Speakers described many forms of violence, including rape by acquaintances, strangers, and sexual harassment. The New York Radical Feminists stated that the purpose of their event was to, quote, "counter myths that one, women cannot be raped against their will, two, women really want to be raped, and three, women make false rape accusations." As a follow-up to the Speak Out, the organizers, which included author Susan Brown Miller, whose book I'm going to be talking about later, also held a conference later that year, which was to further explore the origins and politics of sexual violence. The Speak Out and conference in New York marked a turning point in the women's liberation movement when sexual assault became a major focus. Over the next decade, feminist activists brought rape into public consciousness as a legitimate political issue. Within the broader women's movement, activists sought to theorize the origins, of rape and strategize various approaches to combat it. Different wings of the movement developed their own strategies. These included consciousness-raising sessions, self-defense trainings, community education, and the establishment of rape crisis centers and emergency hotlines. In her book, Rape on the Public Agenda, Maria Bevacqua argues that the anti-rape movement can best be understood as a movement within a movement, meaning that the broader women's liberation movement, also known as the Second Wave, was its central driving force. Feminist anti-rape activism was fundamentally linked to the Second Wave, both politically and organizationally. As one activist observed, the issue of rape was in no way ever separate from the question of the whole liberation of women. A primary goal of the anti-rape movement was to redefine rape as an act of violence. Previously, legal approaches to rape had accepted the supposed phenomenon that women will often say no when they really mean yes. Rape by acquaintances or a spouse was scarcely recognized as assault. Activists aimed to contest a set of cultural rape myths, among them that rape is rare, only social deviants and outcasts commit rape, black men and working class men are most likely to be rapists, women provoke rape, and it is impossible to rape a woman because if she does not want it, she will resist. While today we unbelievably continue to resist many of these same myths, feminist anti-rape ideology successfully introduced a more feminist or victim-centered understanding of sexual assault into both the legal realm and public consciousness. Anti-rape activists worked within existing feminist and left formations and also formed new groups to organize against sexual violence. Chapters of Women Against Rape or WAR and other organizations were established in many cities. As with any emerging movement, there was a process of defining their understanding of violence and the best ways to counter it. In their 1970 statement of purpose, the Chicago Women Against Rape linked the struggle against sexual assault to not only sexism, but racism and class as well. They argued, "Rape violently reflects the sexism in a society where power is unequally distributed between women and men, black and white, poor and rich. In rape, the woman is not a sexual being, but a vulnerable piece of public property. The man does not violate society's norms so much as take them to a logical conclusion." The development of a mass-based women's movement in the context of the Black liberation and anti-war movements provided the necessary infrastructure for activists to draw radical conclusions about the complex nature of sexual violence and its relationship to oppression. This wave of social upheaval led an entire generation of activists to believe that revolutionary change was not only possible, but imminent. In 1972, the founders of the DC Rape Crisis Center declared that their mission was to, quote, abolish rape in our own lifetimes. This was a goal that to them seemed attainable. In 1973, rape became a critical area of focus for the Liberal National Organization for Women, or NOW, who responded in turn to a rising rape consciousness. At the time of its founding in 1966, NOW did not include any mention of rape in their statement of purpose or Bill of Rights. After having played a leading role in legalizing abortion, NOW's National 1973 conference voted to form a rape task force. As Bevacqua describes, the task force was charged with examining existing rape statutes, proposing a model rape law to recommend to state legislatures, researching the treatment of rape victims, investigating sound self-defense tactics, and looking into the possibility of coalition with other anti-rape groups. Over the next 2 years, over 200 NOW chapters participated in anti-rape organizing. While NOW's actions prioritized mainly public policy reform, radical feminists and activists within smaller local anti-rape organizations developed multi-pronged approaches to fighting sexual violence. Their efforts involve the establishment of rape crisis centers, holding community education meetings, and distributing informational anti-rape literature. This literature, produced by activists, contained both helpful and at times questionable information. Recommendations for action found in anti-rape pamphlets range from advocating self-defense techniques to forming women's night patrols and actually encouraging gun ownership. And I really think it's worth taking stock of the limitations of some of these individual strategies, because self-defense and assertiveness classes and these types of strategies, I'm sure were extremely empowering for many of the people who organized them and participated in them. But at the same time, like, these approaches still place the burden on individuals to protect themselves against systemic violence. Strategies for personal empowerment may be beneficial to individuals, but as a political project, they fail to prevent rape from occurring, and they ultimately don't get our movement closer to winning a world free from oppression and violence. For those anti-rape organizations who formed rape crisis centers, an additional set of questions arose. The first rape crisis center was founded in 1972 in Washington, D.C., and was initially operated out of one member's home. Crisis activists researched the experiences of survivors and sought to provide the life-saving and affirming services that were not being offered in hospitals and police stations, the traditional sites where one might go seeking help. Many rape crisis centers combined a direct service approach with on-the-ground activism, understanding their work as fundamentally political in nature. However, as crisis activists necessarily came into contact with the state and all of its institutions, they struggled to maintain their independent political commitments. Bevequo puts it succinctly, to be able to secure funding, attract volunteers, and enjoy a collegial relationship with law enforcement and hospital personnel, that is, to be able to function, rape crisis centers must collaborate with the very institutions they intend to transform. Though crisis centers were first developed by radical feminists who distrusted police and the criminal legal system, most centers adopted a neutral approach, allowing victims to choose whether or not to report their assaults. Establishing this relationship with the courts constrained their work as anti-racist and feminist, and at the same time, strangely held the potential to unite the movement's liberal and radical forces. Though they each approached rape from different political perspectives, they were often united by a shared emphasis on individual change and legal reform. An unfortunate overlap with the rise of Nixon's tough-on-crime policies further compromised the political development of the emerging rape crisis center movement. The anti-rape movement had only just reached its height when the entire women's movement began to wane by the mid-70s. This downturn, which occurred across the left as a whole, caused many activists to lessen their visions for change. In this environment, some feminists even embraced right-wing ideas. For example, Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin joined with conservative forces in an anti-pornography campaign. Similarly, law and order approaches to fighting rape gained an appeal among some former radicals and crisis centers were one of the venues that facilitated this. A notable exception was a project taken up by Black feminists within the DC Rape Crisis Center, who supported a Prisoners Against Rape group after they were contacted by incarcerated men wanting to organize within prisons. This was a sharp break from the gender separatism that most radical feminists practice. I think it would also be worth going in depth about the anti-violence organizing and theory of the Combahee River Collective. But because we have some of those members speaking with us this weekend, I'm going to leave it to them to cover that history. It's awesome that I can say that. Though majority white women's groups were often the face of the anti-rape movement, Black feminists and other women of color were involved throughout, sometimes joining multiracial groups or choosing to organize within Black multigender or women-only groups. Black feminists offered valuable critiques of anti-rape ideology and strategy when racism was not adequately addressed. While many activists linked their analysis of rape to racism and class, the movement often fumbled in practice. To cite a few examples, One article published in the feminist periodical It Ain't Me, Babe in 1970 urged women of all races not to get in a car with a man of another race because, quote, men vent their racial hostility against other men by taking it out on their women. Another example, a group of white women in Dallas were also sharply criticized for a tactic of publishing a list of names of all the men in their county that had been indicted for rape since 1960. The activists had wanted to highlight the fact that most women are raped by men they know. Yet this action had failed to had really failed to consider the racism and class bias of the legal system. The politics of the anti-rape movement were most influenced by its two dominant wings, which I've already spoken about, liberals and radical feminists. The capital R, radical feminism, which is what I'm going to be talking about now, describes a set of politics unique to feminists who embraced an analysis of patriarchy theory. The theory, which views gender rather than race or class as the primary division in society. Feminists such as Shulamith Firestone, Susan Brown Miller, and others developed their own articulations of patriarchy theory to explain the origins of women's oppression. In their view, Marxism and other theories had failed to accomplish this. Relying in varying degrees on psychological and biological explanations, patriarchy theorists locate the root of women's oppression in an innate male domination. The clearest example of patriarchy theory's place in anti-rape ideology comes from Brown Miller's book, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape, originally published in 1975. And the book was truly groundbreaking by bringing an analysis of rape as a systemic problem to a mass audience. When she first began her research for the book, she told an interviewer that she had learned that there were actually more library entries under rapeseed, which is a type of plant, than there were for rape. Brown Miller puts forward a historical understanding of rape as an entrenched aspect of US and world history. However, the theory behind her main arguments is deeply flawed and actually leads her to make many dubious, even racist conclusions. In her first chapter, The Mass Psychology of Rape, she describes the evolution of sexual violence in biological terms. I'm going to quote at length here. Man's structural capacity to rape and women's corresponding structural vulnerability are as basic to the physiology of both our sexes as the primal act of sex itself. Had it not been for this accident of biology, an accommodation requiring the locking together of two separate parts, there would be neither copulation or rape as we know it. This single factor may have been sufficient to have caused the creation of a male ideology of rape. When men discovered that they could rape, they proceeded to do it. Brown Miller theorizes that rape has occurred as long as humanity has existed because of men's supposed inherent biological capacity to rape. She imagines a terrifying prehistoric world where early men bonded over their shared victorious conquest of women's bodies. These statements really, to me, illustrate the dominant perception within the women's movement at the time that sexism was the product of a transhistorical power struggle between all men and all women. In the next paragraph, she ends with her most quotable line, but I want to also quote it in full. Man's discovery that his genitalia could serve as a weapon to generate fear must rank as one of the most important discoveries of prehistoric times, along with the use of fire and the first crude stone axe. From prehistoric times to the present, I believe rape has played a critical function. It is nothing more or less than a conscious process of intimidation by which all men keep all women in a state of fear. Brown Miller's account of human prehistory contradicts the most recent findings of anthropologists, who have discovered much evidence to support a very different image of early human society, one where men and women lived in relative equality. While Marxists share radical feminist analysis that rape has historically served as a weapon of war and social control, we disagree that this has always been a feature of human society from the dawn of time. As Rachel just explained, it wasn't until the rise of class society that the gender division of labor allowed for the conditions for women's oppression to take hold. If you accept the idea that all men are complicit in a system of sexual violence and all women relegated to victimhood, this has very real implications for coming up with strategies to combat rape. If cisgender men simply rape because of biology, why do most men not rape? How do we explain the sexual victimization of men and epidemic violence against transgender people? These questions and more cannot be answered through patriarchy theory's narrow framework. This formulation also leads Brown Miller to argue in a later chapter that as a male, Emmett Till, who was a 14-year-old black boy who was lynched in 1955, was actually complicit in a system of male violence by virtue of his gender, as he had been accused of whistling at a white woman. She had wrongly concluded that the approaches to fighting rape within the civil rights movement were anti-woman. By casting all men, regardless of race and class, into the same category, patriarchy theorists wind up counterposing women's liberation with black liberation and other struggles against oppression. The failures of the feminist anti-rape movement to fully integrate anti-racism into their project points to the need for a more expansive history of resistance to sexual violence. With this in mind, the history of the anti-rape movement necessarily involves looking at resistance that took place within multiple movements over several decades. Early anti-lynching campaigns advanced an analysis of sexual assault as a racist terror tactic going hand in hand with lynching. In the imagined formulation of rape as a crime committed only by black men against white women, black women simply don't exist. Anti-lynching activist and journalist Ida B. Wells, one of her pamphlets and probably an old edition. Everybody should read her. Ida B. Wells was among the first to advance a political understanding of sexual assault in 1892. In her critique of racist mob violence, she explains how the same ideology which promotes the lynching of black men for false rape accusations also fails to provide any justice for black women who are raped. Wells argues, "Very scant notice is taken of the matter when this is the condition of affairs. What becomes a crime deserving of capital punishment when the tables are turned is a matter of small moment when the Negro woman is the accusing party." Wells' speaking tours helped inspire the middle-class black women's club movement, which resisted extralegal killings and racist notions of black women's hypersexuality. By 1930, middle-class white women followed suit by forming the Association of Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching, an all-white group which contested white men's claims to chivalry as a justification for lynching. And they actually had thousands of members, apparently. So to wrap up my section, I want to end with a case that I really feel best illustrates the power of struggle and solidarity in combating sexual violence. And I'm really going to be brief here, but I'm going to pitch this book again because Danielle McGuire is the author who really provides the details. And it's worth the read so you can get the whole picture. Though anti-rape activism was taken up by many movements independently, the 1975 Joanne Little case finally brought these efforts together. Joanne Little was a 20-year-old black woman who was serving a 7-to-10-year term for a string of shoplifting charges at Beaufort County Jail in Washington, North Carolina. On August 27, 1974, a white guard named Clarence Algood entered her cell. Armed with an ice pick, he attempted to assault her. Little managed to grab the pick away from him and proceeded to fatally stab him in self-defense. Incredibly, Little escaped the jailhouse and made it to a family member's home. Days later, Little turned herself in after she had secured a civil rights lawyer. She was indicted by a grand jury for first-degree murder. If found guilty, she would face execution in the state's gas chambers. As McGuire argues, Little's fate may have been sealed if the year were 1955 and not 1975. Two decades of transformation wrought by the civil rights and women's movements had totally transformed the political landscape. Still, Little's case, which the Chicago Tribune called the trial of the decade, would either confirm or deny black women's legal right to defend themselves from white men's attacks, a right historically denied to them dating back to slavery. Feminists, black liberationists, and prison reform activists built a nationwide coalition campaign to save Little from execution. The Women's Legal Defense Fund, the Feminist Alliance Against Rape, the National Black Feminist Organization, NOW, and the NAACP all raised funds for her defense. Rosa Parks and Angela Davis were among her most vocal supporters. On the first day of Little's trial, a multiracial crowd of 500 activists rallied outside the courthouse. They carried signs reading, "We will defend ourselves against sexual assaults," and "Defend black womanhood." They chanted, and this is really a historic chant, 1, 2, 3, Joanne must be set free. 4, 5, 6, power to the ice pick. It's pretty amazing. After a five-week deliberation, the jury unanimously voted to acquit Little. Through tears, she exclaimed, "It feels good to be free." Though justice had been denied to Racy Taylor and so many other black women, the combined strength of some of the most powerful movements in U.S. history had finally won this most basic victory. If the Joanne Little case teaches us anything, it's that rape can't be simply educated or jailed away. Because sexual violence is so entangled in our society from the core, winning a world free from rape means tearing down every form of oppression and fighting for a world where no one is denied bodily autonomy and freedom from violence. Thanks.
So both of my comrades have addressed the historical context of sexual assault and the way in which it functions under capitalism. I want to take up more recent struggles, what we can learn from the demands of the past and the struggles from the past, and how we can move towards eradicating sexual violence. There are so many examples of not only the neglect, but the perpetuation of sexual assault by a system that thrives off of exploitation and the subsequent oppression of marginalized groups within society. From sexual violence committed by the police, to assaults committed by media stars such as Cosby, to rapes committed on campus, to even our now president of the United States. I want to emphasize that the fight back, that there is fight back taking place and taking lessons from these struggles that we see into today to learn how to achieve our goals and win victories. So one of the most prominent mass movements that have been seen in recent years are the slut walks. That began when a police officer in Toronto told college students that, quote, "women should avoid dressing like sluts in order not to be victimized." This sparked a movement that spread across the world that consisted of marches where survivors were making statements about their right to exist without victim blaming. It was made clear that excuses regarding what a person was wearing, whether or not they had any substances in their system, or if they had a prior relationship with the attacker, would no longer be tolerated to invalidate the claims of those who had been victims of sexual assault. The demands of this movement touched people of all walks of life and took up a lot of intersections that in sexual violence, such as the way sexual violence impacts immigrants, sex workers, people of color, and disabled. This movement made demands regarding bodily autonomy and the rights of those who are assaulted to have access to healthcare and to be taken seriously. This began a necessary conversation about the impact of sexual assault, the breadth of victims, and the flippant nature with which officials regard this issue. This was significant because the popular arguments would focus on hookup culture and miscommunication as the reasons why sexual assault is so prevalent. This is inconsistent with the fact that, as previously stated by my comrades, a minority of men commit rapes, and this minority are often serial offenders. This is a common narrative used to invalidate the claims of survivors. And this can also be seen used throughout society And I'm going to talk more about this later when I get into the administration of on college campuses. So while the demands of the slut walks are necessary steps in making sure victims are taken seriously and have access to resources to help them deal with their assault in whatever way they deem best, I think that there's an element missing that is taken up when looking at the struggles that have taken place across college campuses. While consequences and resources are necessary in the struggle against sexual violence by providing support for survivors, there's an element of systemic perpetuation that in the systemic way that violence is used and perpetuated. College campus struggles have taken place precisely because of the unique situations on campuses allow for a focus on the way in which the administration not only halts the seeking of justice by survivors, but ostracizes and attacks those who speak out. An example of this is a student at UNC, Landon Gamble, who decided to speak up about her assault and was subsequently found guilty of violating the honor code and was expelled. This can be contrasted with an incident at Stanford University. Not talking about Brock Turner, but worth mentioning that this is also the environment that produced Brock Turner. A student who was found guilty of sexual assault at Stanford University received a one-year suspension to be served after graduation and before attending Stanford's graduate school, where he had already been accepted. The struggles against sexual assault on campuses has taken on systemic ineptitude rather than only looking at consequences for perpetrators. Some of the strongest examples of this work come out of Columbia University. Most of us have heard of the Carry the Weight Art exhibition that inspired an international movement regarding campuses around the country and around the world. However, an important part of setting the foundations for that work were coalitions such as the Coalition Against Sexual Violence and the more radical group No Red Tape. These coalitions formed out of the growing concern of students on Columbia's campus following articles published in the campus publication, The Blue and White. The formation of these coalitions led to actions such as posting flyers all over campus with red tape as a way to raise awareness about the administration's lack of action in regards to tackling sexual assault on campus and providing resources for victims. These coalitions also made demands regarding violations of the Clery Act, which requires universities to report accurate statistics regarding crimes committed on campus, as well as Title IX, which is supposed to protect against discrimination based on gender. In addition to this, demands were also made regarding removing deans from the process of deliberating over sexual assault on campus and ways to deal with this. And following the demands that had been made, the administration made changes. However, these changes did not have students included in the process and thus did not reflect their wishes. Then in the second half of 2014, a senior at Columbia named Emma Sokowitz centered her thesis around her own experience with sexual assault during her sophomore year, where the assault took place in her dorm room in her own bed. She carried her mattress around campus as well as across stage at her graduation to represent the burden that survivors of sexual assault are forced to carry single-handedly. Sokowitz said, quote, "I will be carrying this dorm room mattress with me everywhere I go for as long as I attend the same school as my rapist." The title of this art piece was Mattress Project, Carry That Weight. This sparked a series of what were called collective carries that were organized with the name Carry the Weight Together, where students would help Sokowitz carry her mattress around campus. This then grew to where others began bringing out their mattresses as well as an act of solidarity. The recognition of by students that the administration is a part of the problem is summed up by the statement by Camilla Korda, a member of the No Red Tape Coalition, as well as an ISL member who happens to be in the room. She says, quote, "The general statement at Columbia is, yeah, administrators aren't perfect, but they really do have our best interests at heart, and they're trying their best. But at the rally, survivor after survivor came up and said how the administration was screwing them over, essentially. After one student came out and directly asked Dean Valentini why he's letting her rapist stay on campus, all of the students started chanting, fuck you, deans. It was also, there were also a lot of signs that people were holding up, a lot of fuck you signs. That just never happens here. Another member of the No Red Tape Coalition, Zoe Rodolfi Starr, made the statement that it was more and more clear that we have to bring this issue to his literal doorstep in order to make sure our voices are heard and survivors are protected in this community. This shows that students were recognizing the collective power that they have and were clearly identifying the systemic issues at play and that simply seeking consequences on an individual basis wasn't going to fix this problem of sexual assault they were facing. Columbia is simply one example of struggles that have taken place on campuses, but this type of systemic injustice can be seen in extremely similar ways looking at colleges from Rutgers University to UNC to University of Wisconsin-Madison to UC Berkeley. Clearly, this is not simply a coincidence. Looking at the way in which campus struggles are grappling with how the current system not only ignores but perpetuates and uses sexual violence is incredibly important in tackling the roots of sexual violence and the way in which it has been and is still used to enforce and uphold structures of power. This lesson can be extended outside of college campuses and make a connection to college campus struggles when looking at police brutality. This can be seen in the case of Oklahoma police officer Daniel Holtzclaw. In 2016, Holtzclaw was sentenced to 263 years in prison for sexually assaulting numerous women throughout his years as a police officer. Holtzclaw targeted some of the most vulnerable women in society. His victims were almost exclusively women of color in poor neighborhoods, most of which had some sort of criminal record relating to crimes of poverty, such as prostitution or drug abuse. His own statements of in defense of himself exemplify how he picked these women, knowing that this case would be hard won. In relation to one of his accusers, Janie Liggins, who was the first to be interviewed, Holtzclaw said, "Let's get the factual facts out there. She's not innocent the way people think she is. She had a bust in the 80s, but we couldn't present that to the jury. This is not a woman that's, you know, a soccer mom or someone that's credible in society. These are the people who are supposedly supposed to protect and serve." While he was convicted, most of the victims were fully aware that this was not the most likely outcome of the case. Most of these victims did not speak up about their assault until they were contacted by the prosecution. I think one of the reasons that Holtzclaw was able to be persecuted was in large part due to the political climate surrounding these accusations being brought up. I believe Holtzclaw himself gave a profound statement regarding his conviction, saying, quote, "If they didn't convict me, there would be the next Ferguson deal happening in Oklahoma City. And if there was not a conviction, I personally think that this would have been the perfect response and displays the power of mass movements of people in the streets." The case not only shows the power structures at play, but exemplifies the lasting racial components of sexual violence, its origins and impacts that both Rachel and Lauren had talked about earlier. Unfortunately, cases like this are not rare, and most do not result in conviction. Struggles to indict cops who have been accused of sexual violence span around the country, even right here in Chicago when there were protests in 2011 regarding the rape of a woman in her home after her attackers, who were police officers, offered her a ride home at 2 a.m. Relying on the powers that be and the current system in place does not pose a substantial threat to sexual violence. When there are cops who rape that go unchallenged, and a military that takes careful consideration to cover up its horrible track record of sexual assault, it has been proven time and time again that the system is unreliable. This can also be seen with bourgeois elites that are able to remain in power despite accusations being lodged against them. While consequences for action strengthens a movement and builds confidence, only systemic change will yield lasting results. We should take lessons from the movements of the past and use these struggles as a way of making broader connections to the way in which systemic change is necessary to combat sexual violence. Obviously, we did not have the time to cover the struggle, to cover the full extent of all the struggles we mentioned and the countless others we did not. However, I hope in the discussion that there will be conversation about how we organize around sexual violence, what have been the ways in which people were able to connect the movements against sexual violence with other movements to create even larger mobilizations. Using these mass movements as a way of seeking consequences, raising awareness, and carrying the weight together while working towards the while working towards the ultimate goal of eliminating the need to carry the weight at all.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.